Hello and welcome to St. Paul's Terry Hills. Today we begin a new sermon series in the Old Testament book of Exodus. The series is called Freed to Worship, and today we begin with chapters 1 and 2 of Exodus, and the topic is God Remembers. To set the scene, let me read Exodus chapter 1. These are the names of the sons of Israel who went to Egypt with Jacob, each with his family: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah; Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin; Dan and Naphtali; Gad and Asher. The descendants of Jacob numbered 70 in all. Joseph was already in Egypt. Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died, but the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous, so that the land was filled with them. Then a new king who did not know about Joseph came into power in Egypt. "Look," he said to his people, "the Israelites have become too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country." So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And they built Pithom and Ramesses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with hard labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their hard labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, "When you help the Hebrew women in childbirth and observe them on the delivery stool, if it is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, let her live." The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, "Why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live?" The midwives answered Pharaoh, "Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive." So God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people: "Every boy that is born you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live." So what do we learn here from Exodus chapter 1? Firstly, that Exodus continues the story of Genesis. We know of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We know that Jacob's name was changed to Israel and that he had 12 sons. We know what happened to Joseph, how his brothers sold him into slavery in Egypt, but God blessed him, raising him to prominence in Egypt and eventually saving his brothers in the famine through Joseph. So Exodus begins with the sons of Israel and their families in Egypt with their brother Joseph. Secondly, what do we learn? Time is moving fast. In verse 6, we are told, "Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died." Yet thirdly, we learn that God is fulfilling his promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We read in verse 7, "But the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They greatly multiplied, increased in numbers, and became so numerous that the land was filled with them." Do you remember what God promised Abraham back in Genesis chapter 12? Genesis 1 to 11 tells the story of creation and fall and the decline of humanity into sin. But God has a redemption plan. He chooses Abraham and makes this promise to him in Genesis chapter 12. The Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse, and all the peoples on earth will be blessed through you." This promise to Abram, whose name was changed to Abraham, is the key to the whole story of the Bible. It is the promise of God's redemption plan, worked out firstly in the nation Israel, which we'll see ourselves in Exodus, and then ultimately in Jesus, who is Abraham's true seed who blesses the nations. So there are three things in this promise. God promises Abraham land, offspring, and blessing. L-O-B, lob, an easy way to remember it. Land, offspring, blessing, L-O-B. Returning to the opening of Exodus, what aspect of the promise is being fulfilled? Are they in the promised land yet? No. Is Abraham's offspring a great nation? Well, not yet a nation, but God is beginning to fulfill his promise of making Abraham's offspring as numerous as the stars in the sky. They are increasing in number. And finally, are they being blessed? Well, let's read on in Exodus. Verse 8 of Exodus 1, "Then a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power in Egypt. 'Look,' he said to the people, 'the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country.' So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor." Are they being blessed? No. Now, I should point out that between verse 5 and verse 8, some 400 years has passed by. Exodus chapter 12, verse 40, tells us that the Israelites lived in Egypt for 430 years. As I say, in Exodus 1, time is moving extremely quickly, until we meet the midwives in verse 15. Now, you know when you're watching the movies, and traditionally, movies seem to start by setting the scene. You know, they have sweeping landscape shots in order to locate us. Where are we in the world? What time is it? Gradually moving in to a story that sets the scene, often a side story that introduces the main character or characters in the film. Although these days, they often like to do it from back to front, don't they? They like to start with a bang rather than starting slow. A lot of movies and shows these days seem to start with an intense major incident, and then up comes the caption 3 days earlier or 6 months earlier or whatever it may be. Well, Exodus follows the more traditional pattern. The scene has been set, the broad sweep, and now the camera zooms in on Shiphrah and Puah, the midwives, in verse 15. "The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, 'When you are helping the Hebrew women during childbirth on the delivery stool, if you see that the baby is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, let her live.' The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, 'Why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live?' The midwives answered Pharaoh, 'Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive.'" Now, some people have a problem with what the midwives did here. They say their behavior is deceitful, that they are disobeying the command, not yet given, by the way. We haven't got to Mount Sinai and the Ten Commands, but the command, you shall not give false testimony. But what is their alternative? God says, you shall not murder. Pharaoh is commanding them to murder. God commands them to not murder. Their first allegiance is to God, not Pharaoh. Like the Apostle Peter says in the New Testament, we must obey God, not men. If what man commands us contradicts what God commands, we have no choice but to obey God. The women rightly, quote, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. And did they break God's commands with their false testimony? Well, if we look a bit more closely at what the ninth commandment says, it says, you shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. Does that mean it is acceptable to give false testimony for the good of your neighbor? Perhaps. When the Nazis came to the door and asked, well, they didn't ask, they demanded, are there any Jews hiding in this home? Were the German Christians breaking the ninth commandment when they said, no, there are no Jews hiding in this home, in order to save their lives? Or were they fearing God at great risk to themselves, like the Hebrew midwives? I'll leave you to ponder that ethical question for yourself. Back in Exodus, God himself endorses the actions of the midwives. We read in verse 20, so God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased, and it became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Now, the fourth thing that we cannot overlook in chapter 1 is the evil of the new Pharaoh. His policy is infanticide. Unsuccessful with the Hebrew midwives quietly removing all baby boys, he issues a public order. The Egyptian people are commanded in verse 22, every Hebrew boy that is born you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live. Pharaoh is creating a nation of baby killers. One-child policies, legalized abortion, such laws are abhorrent to God and should be abhorrent to us. But as we know, Pharaoh's justice is coming. So the scene is set. In chapter 2, the camera zooms in on one particular Hebrew child. It's a famous story, beautifully told, beautifully written, and rich with detail. Let me read it for us from Exodus chapter 2. Now a man of the house of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her slave girl to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. "This is one of the Hebrew babies," she said. Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" "Yes, go," she answered. And the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you." So the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, "I drew him out of the water." Now, did you notice in that passage that I just read, God is not mentioned once in that passage. No mention of God. But he is clearly sovereign over every little detail. God is saving baby Moses. More than that, he is ordering events so that he rises to prominence in Pharaoh's house, not unlike Joseph before him. God is blessing his people, so much so that Moses' mother is now being paid by Pharaoh's house to nurse her own child. I just love that detail. And the name Pharaoh's daughter gives to him, Moses, means "I drew him out of the water." We know that Moses is going to come out of the water again in the future in the most significant saving event for the people of Israel. And we know what that will mean for Pharaoh and his army. So there's all sorts of hints and parallels in these early chapters. One of the more significant parallels for us is the saving of baby Jesus in the New Testament. In the days of Jesus, it is King Herod who adopts a wicked policy of killing baby boys in Bethlehem in order to remove a rival to the throne of Israel. And where is it that Mary and Joseph flee to escape Herod? Egypt. God brings his son out of Egypt. The other thing we can take away from this personally is that God is in control of the details of our life. The times in which we are born, who our parents are, the circumstances of our life, the political environment that we're born into, who it is who governs us, and so on. Not all of us miraculously end up being raised in Pharaoh's house, but God still has a purpose for us, and he is at work in all of the details of our life to achieve that purpose. When I think about my own life, a son of Jeff and Shona, born in Brisbane, then my dad gets an opportunity to work here in Sydney. Mum and Dad make the big decision to leave the city they grew up in, their family, moving away from all of our extended family, starting new in a new city, not knowing a soul, changing school as a kid, becoming a banana bender, as they called me when I started in my new school, living amongst cockroaches. It was a big deal. I had absolutely no idea what God had to do with it at the time, and it wasn't until several years later, nearly 10 years later, after all sorts of ups and downs, that God called me and I was able to look back in hindsight and think God had a plan. Maybe this, God's calling of me, wouldn't have happened if we hadn't have moved down here all those years ago. Well, God is in control of Moses' highs and lows, even though at this point Moses is completely unaware of God's sovereignty in his life. Verse 11 of chapter 2. One day after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Looking this way and that and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. The next day he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, "Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?" The man said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "What I did must have become known." When Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. Question: did Moses know he was an Israelite? I guess it depends on how old he was when he left his mother and went to live in Pharaoh's house. I guess it also depends on whether Pharaoh's daughter told him about the beginnings of his life. Either way, Moses does not like what he sees. He defends one of his own people, we are told, murdering an Egyptian slave master. Moses is a sinner, and word has got out, so he flees. His Midian experience prepares him for what is to come. There are all sorts of parallels in his Midian experience. He becomes a shepherd. He will shepherd Israel. He drew water to water the flock, something he will do again in the wilderness, watering God's flock. There's something about Moses and water. Interestingly, in verse 19, Reuel's daughters say, "An Egyptian has rescued us." They don't see him as an Israelite, but they know he is a rescuer. And married to Zipporah, they produce a son named Gershom. And what does Gershom mean? Verse 22 tells us, "I have become an alien in a foreign land." I don't think Gershom's going to make it in the list of top 10 boys' names. "I've become an alien in a foreign land." But Moses is getting the Israelite experience. That's the point. He's in exile, just like his people are in exile. An alien in a foreign land, just like the Israelites. Up to this point, Moses hadn't experienced that. He was at home in Egypt. God was teaching him that Egypt was not his home. As Christians, our tough experiences teach us that we are exiles, aliens and strangers in the world, as the Apostle Peter puts it. Our sin and its negative consequences, our suffering in the world, it's all a refining process preparing us for our future home. There's also a sense in which these things prepare us for the good works that God has in store for us. When we sin and experience the consequences, when we suffer, when we are right in the midst of it, it's really hard to understand what on earth is going on. But God can take it and use it for good in his own timing. In 2 Corinthians chapter 1, the Apostle Paul writes, "Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of compassion and the God of all comfort, who comforts us in our troubles so that we can comfort those in any trouble with the comfort we ourselves receive from God. Paul knew from first-hand experience that God's sovereignty over his life, both his pre-Christian life and post-Christian life, prepared him for service. It shaped him to be able to minister to others, especially those who experienced similar things to him, those who had similar pre-Christian background as him, and those who shared the same experience as Christians, especially suffering for the gospel. Can you relate to this yourself? I certainly can. God has used my sinful pre-Christian past for good, especially to be able to minister to those who have had a similar background. And the things I've experienced as a Christian, including the disappointments and the setbacks and the painful things, God has used them to equip me to support others, especially those going through the same things that I myself have experienced. Well, Moses doesn't yet have that hindsight. He's still in the darkness. He's in exile. But things are about to change. Chapter 2 of Exodus ends with this note. Verse 23, during that long period, that is the period of Moses' exile, the king of Egypt died. And this is the trigger. A change in political circumstances and a personal one for Moses. He knew the heir to the throne. They had been raised as brothers. Reading on, the Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. Let me conclude with this. God hears the cries of his people. When things are bleak, when circumstances are bad, when they are dire like they were for the Israelites in Egypt, it's an opportunity for us to cry out to God, to say, God, I need you. God, I can't do this on my own. I have nothing. I am at your mercy. Please help. And mercy is what he shows to his people when they come empty-handed. God hears, we are told. Not that he didn't hear before. No doubt he had heard cries across the 400 years of slavery in Egypt, but now it's as though the whole of the people of Israel in one loud, desperate voice cry out, and God truly hears. That is, he hears in the sense that he will now act. As we have seen, he has always been active behind the scenes, as it were, but now he is going to come to center stage. God remembers, we are also told. Not that he'd forgotten, not that God is a sleepy old man with Alzheimer's who needs us to remind him of the promises he has made. But that he remembers in the sense that, again, he is about to act to fulfill his promise, his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Brothers and sisters, we are so blessed. We are so blessed because we live post the Exodus. We know how God acts to fulfill his covenant. We live post-Jesus and his death and resurrection, knowing that he is the seed of Abraham who fulfills all of God's promises. We know the big picture of God's salvation plan. We know the promise of the future, that Christ will return and establish his eternal kingdom. It's this big picture that gives us hope and purpose and meaning in the here and now. It helps us to make sense of the details of our life that would otherwise be very difficult to make sense of at times. We have even more reason to cry out, to pray, to trust in the one who hears and remembers, who is faithful and works out his good and perfect plan for our lives. For in all things, God works for the good of those who love him. Amen.